Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and this is another episode for Beyond the Mekong, which is broadcast by The Diplomat. And with me today from London is Dr. Edwin Pugh, who has just written a book, A Doctor's Illustrated Account of Working in Site 8, Khmer Rouge Refugee Camp in 1988. Edwin, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Luke.
Thanks. I've just finished reading your book and it's a terrific account about a little-known refugee camp among many that was constructed in the 1980s when the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia and occupation, I'll quickly add, was still going on. How did you wind up there?
Quite interesting. I'm a medical doctor and my wife's a doctor too. And she was the one that wanted to go to work overseas when we qualified. And we applied for overseas service with a UK Christian charity. And initially we were assigned to Africa, which fell through. And the organization said, but we've got an alternative for you. How do you fancy going to Cambodia or Thailand, Cambodia? We said, yes. They said it would be to refugee camp. We said, well, okay. And then they said it was in a conflict zone and it was Khmer Rouge. And that took our breath away, really. Yeah, but long story short, we decided to go.
It was quite a time. And I remember the sheer dread and fear that the Khmer Rouge, just the mere mention of their name, would conjure up in people's imaginations.
Yes, and we went in fear and trepidation to fight, not knowing really what to expect. We'd done the usual thing, seen the film The Killing Fields. We'd read a lot about the situation, and it was terrible. But in our minds, refugees or displaced people were some people who needed help. And as we discovered, as we thought, most people in the camp were not politically Khmer Rouge. They were ordinary family people who just wanted a quiet life and peace and to be in their homeland.
And I'll just quickly add that Site 8 was controlled by the Khmer Rouge, which were extraordinarily secretive. And it was for that reason that you were responsible to them, and any information about these camps under the Khmer Rouge, it's non-existent really, which is what makes your book conflicted such a handy source material for all sorts of from historians to Cambodian specialists to the Khmer Rouge Tribunal.
And this is one of the reasons I wanted to write it, because there was only one health agency allowed into the camp. And when you went into the camp, it was like entering an embassy grounds. You were entering Khmer Rouge territory, administered by the Khmer Rouge, controlled by the Khmer Rouge, and ordered by the Khmer Rouge. And it was entering a different world. It was entering a different world.
How did it differ from the other camps and outside that world?
I think in the book I say that we're often quoted the first thing to go in war is truth. Well, in a Khmer Rouge camp, the first thing to go is trust. What we experienced was that nobody trusted anybody. The Khmer Rouge had a very oppressive regime of surveillance on their refugees, so that there were spies everywhere. And paranoia wasn't abnormal. Paranoia was real. Everybody feared they were being watched.
And I think
And even the aid agency staff, you knew you were being watched constantly and reported back to the Khmer Rouge leadership.
Right. And as you point out in your book, that includes children who were deployed as spies and members of people's families. And it was at every level of the society, which I think was about 40,000, I'll quickly add. But yeah.
Yeah, there were about 35,000 to 40,000. It kept fluctuating the population because the camp was used by the military. That was a situation that was very uneasy for us because, if you like, the camp was being supplied with provisions, and the camp is right next to the war zone on the Cambodian border. And there were several secretive military camps, satellite camps near us. And of course, provisions for Site 8 were used to help the military.
Right. And as you point out in your inconflicted. The point of the title is that as a doctor, you're not meant to play favorites. And I'll quickly add that as a war correspondent, it's you're supposed to be standing on the same ground in that regard. But you know, you still have your thoughts. You still have your sense of fair play and who's doing what to who, and that can make your job difficult.
Well, we did mention this to the United Nations. One of our rules we felt was to advocate for the refugees and the situation, and that was an issue we raised time and again. If I can make this point, one of the telling things to me in the camp after a few weeks there was to be able to ask somebody why they were Khmer Rouge, why they were supportive of the Khmer Rouge in the past. And what never had come across in the history books to me was the role of the effect of the American bombing on the Cambodia-Vietnam border during the Vietnamese War, when tens of thousands of innocent Cambodians were killed in blanket bombing, the napalm bombs. And the Cambodians lopped family indiscriminately. I mean, they were civilians living a quiet agricultural life. And they turned against the West. And they were a society that wasn't, I don't mean uneducated, they were bright people. But what they learned was the West, through the Americans, was destroying them indiscriminately.
Right.
So they rebelled.
Yeah, there were several reasons. Yep. No, there were several reasons why they joined the Khmer Rouge. Another reason was that Norodom Sihanouk, when he was ousted from government, he went to China and Pyongyang, but he went onto radio from there, which was broadcast into Cambodia, where he advocated that all Cambodians join the Khmer Rouge. And as a result, numbers went from like 5,000 to anywhere between 35 and 50,000. The numbers do vary, but there are a lot of reasons for opposing the status quo in those days.
Yeah, it was a terrible situation. And the Khmer Rouge was, it only existed for a few years, but it actually was supported. The Khmer Rouge at the time we were in the camp,
yeah.
The Khmer Rouge was supported by the US, UK, and Thailand.
Right.
So to fight the Vietnamese, basically, as buffer against the Vietnam.
Yeah, the Americans were sore losers on that score after 75. But the list of diseases you've gone into and in conflict, obviously you're a doctor and a medical doctor, and you've taken a clinician's eye view of what you witnessed, but take us through some of the horrendous diseases and issues that the people in Site 8 that they faced.
Yeah, one of my past lives, I was an epidemiologist, a public health doctor, and when we got to Site 8, documentation wasn't particularly good. There were no birth certificates, death certificates. Nobody was keeping a track of what the diseases were. So we started a surveillance program. And I was quite amazed to see what the diseases were that came up. The big one was malaria, which was everywhere, affecting all age groups. But it was interesting for children in the camp. The biggest cause of death was drowning. And that certainly blew my mind, because this was very young children. And the reason was the industrious Khmer, very resilient, were building little fish ponds in the camp to grow fish for added food and protein. But of course, the fish ponds were deep and the children would fall in. They were in safety, didn't this?
Yeah, sorry.
And other things like dengue fever and, of course, war injuries. We got, because we were part, there were satellite military camps around, the military brought their war wounded in,
mm-hmm.
For treatment and triage. So that was another element.
Yeah, I noticed too that you tried to run several campaigns there to reduce the malarial numbers with, the impression I was left with was disappointment and not a lot of success, but just getting the kids to wear T-shirts to limit their skin exposure, the introduction of fish into ponds so that they would eat the larvae of the malarial-carrying mosquitoes. But it sounded just very difficult to get the message across.
there was a huge positive being in the Khmer Rouge camp, because if you can get the leadership to agree to a public health measure, it would happen. The t-shirts didn't work. I couldn't get that rule passed. But we had chemicals put in the water to kill mosquito and dengue larvae. And the Khmer Rouge leadership supported that. And every home that had a water jar had chemicals in the water. There was 100% compliance. And things like vaccination, the same. The people were instructed and supervised and watched to have vaccination. So from a public health point of view, there were some benefits. It was a very attractive regime.
It was amazing how many people were coming in from the camps too, in that life sounded miserable in those camps, but at the same time, it must have been a damn sight better than what it was outside those camps. And particularly, you spent a lot of time talking about pregnant women and the issues they had, and particularly with malnourished, they were barely children, they were babies.
Yes, they came from outside. If you were inside eight, you got a food allowance. And that was carefully calculated. So you got the right amount of calories and mix of proteins and carbohydrates a day. It was basically rice and fish with few vegetables. So that if you were in the camp, registered, receiving those provisions, you were relatively healthy. But in the outside camps, there was no aid, and people were malnourished. Children were malnourished and starving. And they were brought in for treatment in the camp.
What were the worst examples that you saw? You made a point, the wounds, the landmine injuries were horrendous, and the photographs that went with them inspired a few memories, actually, but yeah.
Luke, I don't know about you, but when you portrayed landmines, you fear things like legs are blown off, or you lose an arm, or you lose a leg. You don't. The shrapnel goes through your body. A leg isn't lost. A body is kind of macerated because of the shrapnel. And to see how many people were injured through landmines, innocent people, because they're indiscriminate. They don't just kill or maim their soldiers. It was truly heartbreaking for me. And to think that the lesson for today, to think this is still going on, that people are manufacturing these anti-personnel landmines, to me, it's just abhorrent.
The wounds are extraordinary. It's, without wanting to state the obvious too much, but it's not a clean cut. Where the leg is blown off, it's mangled. Or I've seen other photographs, I've seen other wounds where it's the leg is being partially mangled by a landmine, and it's not going to grow back. So much.
No. The other thing is that I hadn't really. I learned a lot about landmines in 2 years. It's not a clean wound. The landmines are underground, so as well as the shrapnel going to your body, you get all the soil and muck, and the dirty wounds. And you can't just sew up a wound. You have to leave it open till it becomes clean. And the other thing is, it isn't just a leg. The shrapnel goes. If you can imagine that the landmine is exploding below you, usually, you've got shrapnel going up into your lower abdomen and groin, and it's
really horrific. Really, right? And given what you.
With the landmine going up, Luke?
In the distance, I had. I was up in the Khmer Rouge areas interviewing Kusan Pan. That was back in 2000. So I did some time in Iraq and Afghanistan and several other conflict zones also. I've been out with D-miners up close and I've seen victims of bombing, certainly, and the mangled mess that leaves. But I haven't had a landmine go off right next. Remember being in landmine territory out in the back of nowhere in Afghanistan, and I've walked through mined areas on paths. There are certain rules about what you pass through. But no, thankfully, I haven't been exposed to an actual detonation and to be standing close by.
So it was a few years later, I continued development work in Cambodia, went to one of the Healer Trust works, and it was my birthday, and they arranged for me to set off a landmine. And what hit me was, one, the explosion is quite a big explosion, but there's a shockwave with it, which if you're close, really affects your ears. It's quite interesting. And the other thing I learned about landmines is they move. So in Thailand and Cambodia, they're planted in the soil. But when the monsoons come, soil is kind of swept down mountainsides, and when the soil is, the mines move.
Yeah, a lot of the mines have been made safe. That's not the right word, but they're no longer of use because they've been the plastic in them is bloated. But that doesn't mean they're not safe. I mean, can't choose it. But no, it's extraordinary. I mean, when I was interviewing Q Sampan all those years ago, we were sitting on his back porch, and you'd hear this. Yeah, you'd go, boom, 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 come on, kind of thing. And I'm like, looking at him, and he's like, landmines. I'm like, and what was happening was they used to put in three or four anti-personnel mines around a tank mine, and they were burning off. Now, you or I, if we stood on an anti-tank mine, that wouldn't set it off, and nor would a fire, really, arguable.
Yeah.
But those anti-personnel mines are there. So if you stepped on one of those anti-personnel mines, that would detonate the other anti-personnel mines, which in turn would detonate the anti-tank mine and make a God almighty bloody mess. That was like...
We laugh about it because it's black humor.
Yellow's humor. Yeah, I tell you.
I pick people.
What do you make of the current conflict? All of a sudden, Cambodia sounds like it did 30 years ago. There's a refugee camp with 14,000 to 15,000 people in it. Again, landmines are becoming an issue, with the Thais accusing the Cambodians of laying mines, which I struggle to believe, actually. But nevertheless, the area is still heavily mined from back then, and there are accusations that it's being re-mined. What did you make of all these accusations and the conflict?
I think this is a long problem that's gone on even before the refugee camps that I worked with, in the sense that Thailand, Cambodia, and Laos was once part of Siam. I mean, the history of the place was a huge area called Siam that was then split up into different countries. And along the Dom Sak Mountains, if you like, between Cambodia and Thailand, that was the arbitrary line between the two countries. Unfortunately, there are some very significant religious sites and temples along there. And that land has always been disputed as long as I've been involved in Cambodia.
Right.
And in time, there have been... from time to time, there have been skirmishes along there. And from time to time, the skirmishes have resulted in troops or firing happening. And it needs to be resolved politically. It's a different situation to the Khmer Rouge completely. It's about territory. It's about borderlines. It's about ownership of what is important to the Buddhist community, the temples, who owns them. And it needs to be resolved politically. I hope the countries can get together and come to some agreement that actually maybe the land and the area could be used for the benefit of both countries.
That would be ideal. I'm not too sure if it's going to happen. I think one of the main issues is the border deal struck through the French has given Cambodians control of, depends on where you are, but it's about 100 meters back from the ridge line of the Dangrek Mountains.
Yes.
And the Thais don't like that, because if they had that control, they would then have control over the military high ground into Cambodia, which was occupied by the Khmer Rouge, and that's why it wasn't an issue for 30 years. But
you've hit something that I didn't appreciate that, because in the book, I've got a picture of us looking from the top of the hills into Cambodia. And if you're showing the top of that ridge, it militarily, it's a very strategically strong position.
Indeed. I've got stories from a friend of mine, a Khmer journalist. I won't mention his name, but He tells the story of being in Anlong Veng, which is a fair distance from the border. But it was back in your day when you were there, and there were troops around gathering around Anlong Veng, and the Khmer Rouge took anti-aircraft guns pointing up and simply turned them down, and they could strafe Anlong Veng from the ridgeline in the Dank Mountains. It's extraordinary the control one would have if your military controlled that that line.
No, you're absolutely right, and that you can understand from a political and military point of view why that's important. Yeah, and Cambodia have the upper hand. Well, they have the French legitimate right to that land.
Well, the Thais did sign off on it back in 1909, but then, of course, as you pointed out, they've got a long history over the last 100 years in that the Thais sided with the Japanese during World War II, and in doing that, the Japanese enabled Thailand to invade Myanmar, Laos, and Cambodia. In Cambodia, they went as far as Battambang and the Tonle Sap Lake, and then Cold War, a lot of that was put on hold, and then it re-erupted again at Prairie here in 2008. That was technically a three-year conflict, but the ICJ the International Court of Justice, has twice affirmed that that is sovereign territory belonging to Cambodia.
Yeah.
It must have stirred a few memories.
It did. And I worked in refugee situations again in a few years later. After leaving the camp, so I was asked to go to Rwanda at the start of the genocide.
Wow.
And it was the different refugee situation. It was the first month of the genocide.
Yeah.
And we were stationed at Goma inside Congo. And the refugees were pouring out of Rwanda through Goma and being put on the foothills of an inactive volcano. The volcanic rock was as hard as iron. And these people had nothing. And they would leave, the people would just drop, and they'd be left in the exodus. It was truly heart-wrenching. And comparing the situations, I'd Aid was an organized, established camp with all the aid going in. Rwanda was just hellish chaos, and the organizations hadn't really started to get to grips with the scale of the problem, and that would. Oh, truly horrendous.
I remember Rwanda. Yeah, Rwanda was. It happened quickly. Correct me if I'm wrong. I wasn't there, but I remember when Rwanda happened, and it was just bang. It happened so fast. Or was that because the world wasn't noticing?
I think the warning signs weren't taken. I've read several books, and things were brewing for several weeks between the Hutus and Tutsis, and then it just went, as you said, it went wham, just bang. It started. And there was no choice for these, for the people. They had to escape, and they just poured over. But they had nothing. They had nothing. It was truly heartbreaking, and many were children unaccompanied because they'd lost their parents.
Right.
So in Goma, it was full of Rwandan children living on the street with nothing, just begging. Yeah,
you will. I think.
Refugee work and kind of development works in my blood. And since the refugee days, I have been involved, continue to be involved in Cambodia. And just to say that since the Khmer Rouge days, Cambodia is a completely changed country.
Yeah, we do.
We come from ground zero, where all the skills, mathematical skills, medical skills of the country were annihilated, to now, a generation and a bit later, where the country is recovering, and they're getting those Khmer skilled people back. And I think the role of NGOs, the role of charities in Cambodia is changing, whereas in the past, charities would have to go in. And when I say take charge, it's not because we're better than the Cambodians, but because the charity going in had the expertise and skills.
Whereas
now, I think in Cambodia, charities who go in need to acknowledge that there should be, for me, there should be Khmer leadership, and the Khmer leadership should be supported if they want or need supporting.
No, I agree with you. I think people don't understand what a failed state looks like, and Cambodia was a failed state. And back then, I'm sure, I know, that the Cambodians wanted you to take the lead. as you said, there was a lot of mistrust going around and they had absolutely nothing.
Yeah. And I think that's where we are now. So I bang the drum that we don't need any new charities going in thinking they're going to tell the Cambodian people how to do things. We need specific people with specific skills. It's invited to help the Cambodians develop the services. So, for example, 5 years ago, 14 years ago in Cambodia, I started a UK health charity. We sent teens out to a major hospital in Battambang to work alongside Khmer doctors and to provide education and training on topics that they would like.
Right.
And while we were at the hospital, well, this hospital looked, when we first started, looked after 1 million people in Battambang. It had one X-ray machine,
right,
one radiologist, and one anaesthetist. And the anaesthetist was a nurse. 14 years later, the hospital has come on leaps and bounds. But we noticed a few years ago that there was no mental health, there was no help for children with neurodisability. And the concept of autism, for example, was a novel one. So we started a charity in the UK that goes out to train Khmer professionals who look after children with special needs about autism and to give them the skills. You take on that responsibility.
There's a slow awakening to these sorts of diseases that before just were not on the Khmer radar.
Oh, and you get shocked when you go to Cambodia if you're from England or USA or Australia. Like, you're entering a young population. When I first went, you didn't see an old person. And old, I mean, over 50. Because it just didn't exist. And the diseases were all geared to young people. There was no, when we first started, heart disease, cancer, just wasn't apparent. It was infectious disease, accidents. But now Cambodia society is getting older and the diseases of older people are now coming to the fore. So people are getting blood pressure, heart disease.
Overweight, dare I say. Oh, isn't that a luxury? You went back in 2024. I'm assuming that what you're saying at the moment is a lot of it was based on that experience. But how was it personally to get back there and see how the country held them? As you mentioned, it's come a long way.
Well, yeah, I mean, since 1988, I've been back not every year, but most years.
Okay.
So I've seen the country progress. But what I've learned about Cambodia is, and I've got great Khmer friends there now, it's not like going home, but it is home from home. I feel very at ease now. I've seen the country develop. I've seen the resilience of the people. The Khmer people want to learn. They want to be looking after their own country, as it were. They don't want outside assistance other than to help them develop. So it can be, for me, a very wealthy country. It's got the agriculture, it's got the young workforce, it's got the tourism, potentially. It's got the mineral wealth. And I think it's developed from being a low-income country to now coming out of that bracket.
It is heading in that direction. Yeah. Yep.
But the recent war hasn't helped. The tourism, I think.
Tourism hasn't really recovered since COVID, and they've had all sorts of issues, including perennial scam compounds, human trafficking, and money laundering accusations.
Yes.
Which, they need to deal with that. But certainly, it's no longer the exotic attraction that it was before COVID. I mean, that's fair to say.
Yeah.
But.
So, and the organizations I work with the Cambodian charity out there. I mean, there isn't the social system like we have in Australia and the UK where people with nothing can get health. There are still people living with nothing. And I'm kind of on the board as an advisor, if I to help this charity in Cambodia. And one of the big things what I'm trying to do, and I think other charities in Cambodia need to do it, they need to look at becoming self-sustainable in Cambodia instead of relying on outside aid. So, for example, USAID, they're now gone to Cambodia.
Yeah.
Those charities relying on USAID, they're really, really struggling. So I'm saying to the charity I work with, how do you raise your own funds in Cambodia? So we're working on a strategy to do that. And we're starting to make some inroads in that. I have a charitable arm that gives free aid. And we have another branch of the charity that's raising funds to be used to provide aid for those that can't afford it.
Yeah, the cancelling of USAID certainly highlighted the extraordinary reliance that quite a few countries had on American aid. And while I think the decision was just unnecessary, they didn't have to do it like that. But what you're saying sounds positive in that, if you want to look after yourselves, you're going to have to raise the money yourselves and run the charities yourselves. And that's not a bad thing.
I think it's mindset. And what I learned is Cambodians, when I was in the camp, it sounds funny, but I used to do teaching. We used to train medics, to doctors and nurses, or to do health procedures. And one day I told them the story. Do you know the story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible?
Sure.
Where the person helped the enemy.
Yep.
If you like.
Well, the Samaritans were very popular among the
Persians. Who was the enemy.
Yeah. The Jewish.
Help the kind Jewish person. I told this story, and they couldn't get the concept of charity. They basically said, well, if that was us, we'd have killed, we'd have left them. You know, the enemy bid. So what hit me back in 88 was the concept of charity in the Khmer Rouge mindset, the concept of charity and helping your neighbor to an enemy while the war was going on was an anathema. You could forget it. And I think that carried on a little way. And I still see little remnants of we'll raise money and help other people, or we'll do things for the people that we don't like. Is sometimes a little bit novel. So what we take for charity in our countries isn't the same mindset as in Cambodia, but it's changing. The ethos is changing there.
I think it's changing as the country, regardless of the economy at the moment, but life has improved. There is more wealth. People can afford to be a little more generous, and that's impacting on the mindset as well.
Yeah, and it's encouraging those people that have the wealth that they can do some philanthropy, they can do some good for the country. But there are still people without anything. I mean, that's the heartbreaking thing.
Yeah,
the very poor. The gap.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, the deep pockets of poverty are certainly still there. With Site 8, with the other sites, Site 2, there was a camp in Thailand. A lot of the people in these other camps managed to get into Thailand, the Thai camps, and from there they migrated to third countries, Australia, the United States, and elsewhere. The people in Site 8, what was their future? What happened to those people?
They weren't eligible for immigration or to be taken out of the situation. But,
right, that's what I was wondering.
People had to be registered, and they had to go through a site called Kawidang, where they would be registered, and then if they were in danger, obviously definitely going back, they went to Australia, America, whatever. But for Thais Aid, that wasn't an option while they were in Site 8, but it was an incentive for some of them to try and escape to Kawidang.
Ah, okay.
So by surreptitious means and a bit of underhandedness, several of them did manage to get to Kawidang, I believe, and ended up in other countries. And what's been interesting is I met Khmers who we've trained in the camp in health work. And they, when they went back to Phnom Penh, they got decent jobs because these people had skills and they spoke a bit of English, if I can put it that way. And some of them have got good jobs straight away. So they've contributed to the development of society and they're giving back to Cambodia, if I put it that way. Can I just mention one other thing? Because when you talk about refugees, it's all one-way traffic about the West going to the our countries going to the refugees. When we take people from the UK, we regularly take nurses and doctors to work in Cambodia. It's life-changing for them. They meet the Khmer people and are absolutely amazed.
they see what the Khmer people have been through, so you have an induction, and then they see the conditions that the Khmer people are working under in the government system. And I'm not decrying the government system. There's not a lot of money, and the standards of care in the government system, although improving, are well behind, I'm sure, what's happening in Australia, UK, America.
Yep.
And the people that go come back absolutely transformed, not just professionally, but humbled in what they've seen, because they see the Khmer people looking after their own, and they see them working in conditions that they wouldn't have believed, with resources so low that they wouldn't understand. And, you know, for most of our countries, we grumble about the health service. But if you've been to Cambodia, you're grateful for what you've got here. And you're also grateful for a society that looks after those that have nothing. So it's not one-way traffic when you work with refugees. I think those that go gain from the experience, both personally and professionally.
Okay. And on that note, Dr. Edwin Pugh, thanks for the chat and good luck with the book, Conflicted. I think it's a mandatory read for anybody with an interest in Cambodia, but it's certainly insightful in terms of Site 8, which was under the control of the Khmer Rouge. And because of that, Khmer Rouge secrecy laws applied, and very little has been done on these camps. So it's good to see this one get published. Edwin, thank you very much.
Luke, pleasure to talk with you, and we'll keep in touch.
Shall do. Edwin Pugh.